Hey folks, it's Mike from Profiling Evil. I've been studying criminal behavior for more than 40 years, and one of my favorite research tools is Truth Finder. It's online, and you're not going to believe the information stored there. So if you want to know more about that new neighbor, your babysitter, or your online date, give Truth Finder a try. I'm including a special link below with special discount pricing, but you got to click the link and enter EVIL10 at checkout. Now, we're an affiliate, which means we get a small commission, but you can cancel at any time. I'm joined today by retired New York City Police Lieutenant Tom Joyce, who worked not only in transit policing for 7 years, working undercover assignments with the decoy squad in pursuit of robbery suspects, but he soon was promoted over and brought in as a sergeant and started working in the 7-7 and the 7-9 detective squads before he was ultimately promoted to lieutenant in that bureau, where he managed major homicide cases and brought his team together to look at some of the ugliest cases in New York City, retiring as the cold case squad commander. Tom, thanks so much for joining up in the show today.
Always appreciate any time I get to talk and hang out with you. So thanks again.
Well, you know, since your retirement, you continue to work with law enforcement on technology and investigative strategies. But I think one of the greatest accomplishments we end up having is our children. You and your wife have three wonderful boys who I think are following in your footsteps of public service. And it's really admirable. You have one who's still finishing up college, but you have another one who's an intelligence analyst in the U.S. Army, and a third who's a police officer in Washington, D.C. That's got to be incredibly gratifying for you, isn't it?
It is. In January of 2019, I asked him how he was doing after he had a year on the job, and he said, "Dad," he goes, "it's what I always wanted to do. It's my dream job, and I couldn't be happier, and I don't think I could see myself doing anything else." Unfortunately, 2020 took a toll on him with COVID, then the riots and the protests. And although he still loves the idea of service, he's second guessing his career right now because he feels he's unappreciated along with his colleagues. I think he'll weather the storm, and they've got good, surprisingly to me, being an old timer, but maybe in this new age of policing, they have resources for them. So they've been doing a good job in making sure they're talking to them. And clearly with the rate of suicide of police officers and military members, I think that awareness has reached a level that it's no longer embarrassing or shameful to ask for help. So I think he's getting all the help he needs, and he certainly gets it from me when we talk through some things. But there's no greater job in the world than the service of our law enforcement military members, in my opinion. And I think he'll ultimately prevail and continue to serve. But I'm not going to sugarcoat it. He had a rough year in 2020.
Yeah, well, God bless him and all those that serve alongside him and around the world. It's amazing to me. I often think, I don't know that today I would have the stomach to go out and do that job. But we are seeing, I think, the pendulum swing back to where the public is realizing that public servants truly are out there protecting them. And I guess it happens over and again. We see the pendulum swing, but the very best to all of them. I want to take you back, gosh, now 20 years, Tommy, to July 22nd, 2000, when this fire rips through a brownstone housing development in Brooklyn, New York. At the end of all of this, there's a 13-year-old girl named Ashley Sims who's found unconscious on a third-floor apartment room. She later dies in a local hospital, and seven other people are really severely injured in this blaze. Can you take a moment and just describe to everybody this area, this part of Brooklyn, the demographics, the kind of people? Help us understand a little bit what this neighborhood's like.
Sure. So Bedford-Stuyvesant, Brooklyn, everyone might be more familiar with the colloquial term Bed-Stuy. You all heard it in the Billy Joel song, "I Walk Through Bedford-Stuy Alone," right? It's right in the center of Brooklyn North, the north end of the borough. New York City being comprised of five different counties, New York County being Manhattan, but Brooklyn is known as Kings County. So on the north end of Brooklyn, Kings County is this little pocket of a neighborhood called Bedford-Stuyvesant. Bedford-Stuyvesant is probably about 2 square miles in total, of which the 79th precinct where I worked at the time was half of that, and then the 81st precinct comprised the other half. I mean, police service areas in New York City are relatively geographically tiny compared to many other cities and many other jurisdictions throughout the country because of the dense population. So we're talking about Bedford-Stuyvesant in total at that time was probably around 120,000 people in a 2 square mile area. So think about the housing developments and the high rises of those developments, and then all of the houses, you know, shoehorned into each block. They got as much living space available on every inch of terrain that you could possibly imagine.
You know, that I got to just say, I mean, it's just always blows my mind as a police officer from out west, where, you know, we have a jurisdiction of 280,000, but it could take 20 minutes to get from one end of town to the other with freeway speeds. I mean, we got a lot of open country, which is what I love. But when you talk about these are populated areas that are small and dense, and unless people have been in those big cities, that it's hard to understand, isn't it?
Oh, sure is. It sure is. And I'll tell you, I grew up in it too. So I didn't live but a mile from there in Brooklyn also. And I think about growing up and having us stacked on top of each other and how densely populated we were. And I wouldn't trade it for anything in the world. I loved it. There was always something to do. There was always someone to hang out with, someone to spend time with. And you could get anything you wanted any time of the day.
I want you to tell me a little bit about Ashley Sims, who this beautiful little gal was. Why was she even in the brownstone at that time?
Yeah, so Ashley, and this is one of the things that really hurt me as a father, was when you think about tragedies that happen to places and then, you know, luck and or being unlucky and being in the right place at the right time or the wrong place at the wrong time. You know, Ashley didn't even live in this house. She was visiting and doing a sleepover with her best friend. And she lived on Grove Street in Bushwick, which, again, is about another half a mile away. But in the form of Brooklyn, that's like forever, you know, because these neighborhoods are so densely populated. But that being said, the one night that she selected and the families agreed to have Ashley sleep over at her best friend's house, this arson took place. So that just compounded the tragedy of it just that much worse. Certainly it shouldn't have happened anywhere at any time, but to think the one night she slept outside of her own bed, that this would happen.
Yeah, that's terrible. I read a lot about complaints, especially from inside the city and the many boroughs, of people complaining about landlords. It's probably a normal thing to complain about a landlord. But you hear some who could even be classified as slumlords. The thing I found interesting is this is a building that had some violations of code in regard to things that could have made a big difference. Maybe you could give a little bit of information on that.
To speak a little bit more about the neighborhood, as you asked before, Mike, there are over 8,800 of these very classic Victorian, what people commonly know them as brownstone buildings. They are gorgeous. They are absolutely beautiful structures. The outsides are beautiful. And then the insides are vast and large. You know, some of them have 13 fireplaces, one fireplace for every room in the house, because they were built, you know, before the turn of the century, you know, going from 1800s into the 1900s. They have beautiful woodwork in them. And so the point of that is not only is this neighborhood deep and rich in history, but the architecture is world renowned and it's beautiful. And these houses are potentially very, very expensive. And so what happened was in 1993, when crime was spiraling out of control in New York City. And the New York City Police Department, as mandated by the new mayoral administration, Rudolph Giuliani, they said, we're going to start tackling this crime issue. And so Bedford-Stuyvesant, Brooklyn, the 79th precinct where I'm working in 1993, had about 70 murders a year in that 1 square mile area. The year that Ashley died, her homicide was number 6 in July. That means that precinct was on pace for 12 murders that year, compared to 8 years earlier when there were 70 murders. So the crime reduction in this city was monumental. And when I worked in the 79 earlier in my career, the 79th precinct earlier in my career, there was not one chain retail establishment, not one chain restaurant establishment. Everything was mom and pop stores. Immigrants or local people trying to make a living, opening up their own business. You know, the grocery stores, the restaurants were all privately small business owned. And that's because of the crime rate. And so when the city finally took control of the crime rate and we had these massive reductions, all of a sudden in the year 2000, 1999, 2000, you start seeing all of these national retailers and chains moving in. All of a sudden, there's a Dunkin' Donuts. All of a sudden, there's an Applebee's restaurant. All of a sudden, because the economic boom in this community skyrocketed. And what happened? The slumlords, if you will, the landlords that were not investing any money into any of these buildings decided, wow, we're starting to see our real estate, the cost of our and the value of our real estate climb through the roof. And so where they're taking, and in this case, some Section 8 and some publicly assisted people living in this home at 27 Brevoort, the building owner who never put any money into the safety issues like you were talking about, the sprinkler system that was not fixed, and they were cited multiple times for not having the sprinkler system working for fire suppression. He finally decided, I need to get everybody out of here. And I'm going to invest money now because I see my rent being substantially higher than what the government is going to pay me for the tenants. So that all comes into play in this case because the building owner had tried numerous ways of getting the people out, and he couldn't do so. It couldn't be done because the government said, no, we're paying for them to stay here, and you can't just throw them out because you want them out. So, you know, he exchanged a deal that you will always get paid your rent every month for taking the Section 8 publicly assisted housing, you know. And then now he wants to break that deal because he sees bigger dollar signs. So when you take the lowered crime rate, these beautiful homes that the values are skyrocketing now, the fact that he's got people in his house that he no longer has an interest in helping and he's greedy, it all, all the worlds collided for his what he felt was his only way of getting everybody evicted is to burn the house down and then rebuild.
Take us to that morning. What happened and what was it like at the time you arrived?
Sure. And to finish up, because I didn't fully answer the first question, Ashley was 13 years old and she was an aspiring WNBA player. She wanted to play professional women's basketball. And just being a beautiful young teenage girl, visiting her friends. So I thought that I wanted to make sure I mentioned that she had dreams and aspirations that certainly a young, beautiful girl should have. Because I was working Monday to Fridays, as the commander of the 79th Precinct Detective Squad, my colleagues like to say, hey, Lieutenant, you work banker's hours. We work around the clock over here. But unfortunately this did happen on a Saturday, where I wasn't working. But due to the severity and sensationalism of this crime, at 2 o'clock in the morning, I was called in. Usually they have coverage. The New York City Police Department is so large that they could have flown in, if you will, sergeants and lieutenants and captains of various executive levels to supervise this investigation. But when it's something this serious involving a child in this manner, they want the specific commander from that precinct to come in and handle it from the start. So although I wasn't on the scene at the time the fire was called in, I arrived at the scene between 7 and 8 in the morning. And when I got there, the fire had just recently been extinguished. All of the victims had been removed to the hospitals. And what I was left with was a smoldering shell of a building. What I specifically remember is all the fire apparatus, the dripping of the water from each, you know, opening, each window, each crack, you know, the water that the fire department uses just still dripping down. You still see the smoke just billowing out from the windows and open doorways. You're stepping over all of the hoses because they still haven't even pulled out all the equipment out of the building. And, you know, I'm getting briefed by a detective and we're asking, you know, what do we have here? And then the fire marshals, who I have to give credit, you know, there's a friendly rivalry between firemen and police officers. Well, I got to tell you, I've worked on a fair share of arsons. Arson, as anyone knows, could be a multiple homicide situation because of the weapon that's used is the fire. It usually goes through the buildings fast, and it usually results in multiple victims. We are absolutely fortunate that only one person died in this case. And although one of the other victims was listed as serious and likely to die, she ultimately prevailed and survived. But I've worked on homicides, triple homicides, quadruple homicides with multiple people killed in other arsons. And my point is the fire marshals are tremendously valuable and highly competent fire investigators and firemen and firewomen, if you will. They still have, I don't think they call them firefighters now. So, but when I started, they were firemen. So, but appropriately, they're now firefighters. They walked me through the scene and they said, okay, Lieutenant, here's what we got. And they said, the fire started here. So they gave us the point of origin and they walked it up the stairs and they showed me the burn patterns. And I'm getting goosebumps right now as I'm talking because they made a prediction that came ultimately to be true. They said, I'm looking at the fire pattern here and I think your arsonist is injured. And I said, why is that? And they said, because it looks like to me that they used straight full up gasoline. And any good arsonist, oh, and that's the other thing too, he's also an amateur, he's not a professional. And I said, why is that? And they said, because he used straight gasoline. He said, an experienced arsonist might opt to use dilution of kerosene and gasoline because it's not as volatile, but with the kerosene or the diesel fuel, if you will, the burn will be hotter. So a professional arsonist will be able to escape without getting hurt. It's not as volatile when it starts, but on the other end of it, they'll get more damage. So if they really wanted to burn this building to the ground, they would have looked for more damage with a kerosene mixture. And so he turned, you know, the fire marshal's walking me through this and he goes, look, this is not absolute, but in trying to help you towards what you're looking at for potentially identifying the subject, think about these things that you're not really looking for a professional arsonist and you're probably looking for somebody who's injured. So when you have a suspect, if they're injured, you can be pretty sure that you've got the right person. And if they're not injured, they may have, you know, they may have not been here. You can't, what we used to call putting somebody at the scene, if you will.
You know, that's interesting. In a domestic violence, we look immediately at those closest in that inner circle. Do we have a relationship then between a building and people when an arson type fire begins like we would in a domestic violence?
Yeah. So there was one interesting person who came up to the detectives right away, who was standing out front with a cell phone, actually a cordless phone in her hand. And it turned out that she was an occupant. And ultimately, the investigation revealed that she was what the suspect claimed to be a former lover, but I believe that they were still engaging in an affair. But she was listed as the building maintenance or building maintainer. She would collect the rent and make sure things were maintained in order for exchange for living there. And it also just happened to be where the suspect lived and stayed overnight when he visited Brooklyn. So, and it was interesting. She was the only occupant that didn't receive some sort of injury. And so, and we asked her, you know, within her first statement, you know, how did you get out? And she said, well, I was asleep and then I saw a flash and I heard some noise and I immediately got out and I started yelling fire, fire. And I tried to get everybody out of the house. And, you know, the people couldn't get out the front door. So they started jumping out of the windows. And although some people were injured from smoke inhalation and burns, other people, their sole injuries were just the injury from jumping out of a fourth floor window and, you know, breaking ankles and legs and stuff like that. So we had a host of different injuries as a result of this arson. But it was interesting that this woman was not injured, was not sick, did not suffer from any smoke inhalation at all. And she was able to call 911 and she was able to be available and not need medical treatment. Ultimately, we found out who she was in relation to the suspect. And subsequent to that, we had dumped her phone, her landline phone. And when she said she was asleep, we have her active on, at the time, was dial-up AOL through your regular phone lines. So she didn't have, you know, this is 2000, so there wasn't a dedicated internet line. It was your dial-up phone line, and she was online from 11 o'clock at night until the fire happened. And what we thought was interesting is we thought that she stayed online and was surfing the internet to stay awake so that she would be ready for when the arsonist lit the fire, because we believe this was a plan the whole
time. This is amazing to me. So help me understand which apartment she lived in or which floor, where the fire originates, and how quickly it spreads floor to floor.
Yeah, sure. So if you look at it, the way the building is arranged, if you look at the front steps, which in Brooklyn we call them stoops. You know, I don't know what they call them in the rest of the country, but Brooklyn, those things are called stoops. So if you look at the front stoop, you'll see there's a half stairway that goes down, and sometimes they call that the parlor, and then the first floor is the first floor. So it's really elevated. So if you're looking at it, it's two steps down, and some people refer to that as the first floor. Some people refer to the – so it's kind of weird. It depends if you grew up there or not. If you didn't grow up there, you don't have the right terminology, right? So – if you went up the first stair, she had that first apartment on the left, and she was right at that front door where that vestibule is where the fire started. So she was able to get out before any substantial damage. So that was also very suspect, too. And then when another thing that was really interesting is we asked her to go back and look for valuables, and we went in and she didn't pull any valuables out, nor did she point to any valuables that were lost. You know, everyone, you know, gets really upset about losing, you know, pictures that's before digital photographs. So, you know, back then in 2000, those photographs would have been hard copies of actual physical pictures. She would have lost those. She barely pointed out any valuables and anything she wanted to take, or did she get upset about losing any property in the fire, which we thought was also very interesting.
Were you ever able to prove that she had taken those out in advance or anything like that?
No, as you know, Mike, being an experienced homicide investigator and every other single detective who's ever worked on any of these criminal investigations, specifically homicides, you can have all the technology in the world. You can have all the DNA in the world. You can have all the forensics. At the end of the day, cases still have to be put together by people talking and putting the pieces of those puzzles together. We're way past the point in time where a single sourced piece of DNA is a slam dunk conviction. And what we didn't get, and although we tried incredibly hard, is to get people, specifically Marissa, because she was the key to this. We wanted to flip her, if you will, because I do think she was a co-conspirator, but you know, we really want the landlord. She wouldn't budge. She did not tell us, and she stuck to her story. I'm sure she was well rehearsed. And, you know, we only have so many tools in the tool belt on an interview and interrogation techniques. And she held tight. You know, just because we trip her up in a lie or inconsistencies does not mean that, you know, we have what we need. And that's why ultimately when this case went to the trial, the first one, the second one, ultimately the third, this is why there was still a very circumstantial case, despite some of the other evidence that seems obvious. But when you're talking about, you know, a jury that needs beyond a reasonable doubt, unfortunately, this investigation left some reasonable doubt to some of the jurors because we didn't get the full cooperation of some of the people that we needed.
Yeah. Folks, I'm talking with Lieutenant Tom Joyce, retired from the New York City Police Department, former commander of the Major Crimes and Cold Case Unit there. We're talking about the 2000 arson fire that killed a 13-year-old young girl, seriously injured seven other people, if I remember right, Tom. Now, the one who was most seriously injured and survived, was she actually the mother of the girl that they were staying with?
Yes, she was the mother of Ashley's friend who they were having their little slumber party. And yeah. And she was also seriously injured. She was listed as likely to die. She ultimately survived, and then she did follow up with some civil litigation as well, which I believe there was some dismissals. So it didn't work out on the civil side as well either. Nothing could ever replace, you know, her losing her daughter's best friend and the injuries that she sustained.
Well, this landlord eventually, not even eventually, immediately leaves town, and you end up having to put a fugitive warrant out. Talk about that process, and then let's talk about the trial.
So if you follow a timeline, the arson homicide took place on Saturday, July 22nd in the year 2000. We had tracked his travels that he flew from the Dominican Republic to Miami and then Miami to Newark, New Jersey on Friday, July 21st. The homicide takes place on Saturday, July 22nd. And then he flies on Sunday, July 23rd, from Newark to Miami to the Dominican Republic on Continental Airlines. So, you know, who flies from the Dominican Republic to Brooklyn for one day and then leaves? You know, we tracked the purchases on his credit cards to see if there were other purchases, like for gasoline. You know, we did all of the things that standard good investigative practices. The best we could do was we were able to put him on an airplane on July 23rd. We got the flight manifest. We tracked down as many of the people who flew with the subject on the 23rd back to Miami. And the one statement that I recall, and I'm rereading some of the paperwork now, is the gentleman who we interviewed said, "Yeah, I sat down in the aisle seat, hoping nobody was sitting there. A flight attendant came up to me, told me I needed to move. I was sitting in the wrong seat, and then I look up at this guy, and he's bandaged up. He's got what clearly looks like burns, and he's in terrible pain." And he smells, quite frankly. Now, our subject turns out that he was attending medical school in the Dominican Republic, and he might have already even been deemed a doctor and still finishing up his studies and doing maybe a residency type of assignment. And then the guy asked him, our witness asked him, like, "Are you okay? And you look like you should be in the hospital or in a doctor's office." And he said, "I am a doctor. I'm self-treating."
So what that firefighter said, that it was absolutely true. The guy was burned in the same fire that allegedly he started.
That's right. So what was really interesting to us is we kept telling his mistress, Marissa, is we need to interview Antonio. We need to interview Antonio. We need to interview Antonio. And we're like, how does this guy's building burn down and he's not making himself available to us? Where is he? And no one knew. So we eventually tracked him to the back to the Dominican Republic. Clearly, we'd have to make a travel to the Dominican Republic to interview and put eyes on him to see these injuries. But what I need to make sure you understand is the interview that I'm talking about actually took place 2 months later, because it took us that long to figure out to get down to the Dominican Republic, put eyes on him, which we did before this interview. And that's when we said, okay, we've got these burns. We know he's injured. We need to go track down everyone on that plane. We need to put him on that plane with the injuries. And that was significant. And that's what we were able to do. So that was a big win for the investigation. So when we went to the Dominican Republic to interview Antonio, we obviously put eyes on him. We tracked him down in St. Pedro de Macarís. And we asked him, you know, we saw his injuries. We asked him what happened. He said he was involved in a car accident. They opened up a radiator on the car and he got hit with the burning fluid. And then we asked him about where he got treated. And this is where part of the investigation really crumbled, although I will take some responsibility at a later point in time on why we didn't get a conviction. But the medical records were all handwritten paperwork. The log to be admitted to the hospital that he went to for this treatment was all done retroactive, and it looks like it was filled in after the fact and squeezed in between. But because these logs were so crude, and this is the year 2000, you know, but in the Dominican Republic, because these medical records were so crude that we couldn't say that there's no way this was done after the fact retroactive, their records were so poor they could realistically be true. Again, everyone knows common sense that it's probably not true, but again, it left that little bit of reasonable doubt that it's possible, you know? So that was the putting eyes on him, seeing the injuries was a win. Putting him on the plane was a win with the gentleman who sat next to him that positively ID'd him as having the injuries. But the other side of it is the poor medical records couldn't refute his story. And then ultimately, if I can fast forward, and maybe not the time, Mike, but the first trial was an acquittal. We couldn't get the unanimous jury. The second trial was a mistrial, couldn't get a unanimous jury. The third one was an acquittal because what we didn't do was we should have put him on a plane, or we couldn't put him on the plane flying into New York without the injuries. And I think about that all the time, because if we had someone who said on that plane, I saw that man, I identify him, I sat next to him, that is positively him, and he was not injured, that would have proven that he got injured in New York. But you can't prove the negative. Nobody remembered him. They should have remembered him with his injuries and the extent of his injuries, but they wouldn't have because he wasn't injured on the 21st. Therefore, he was unremarkable. Therefore, nobody remembered him. And we tried to explain, you know, the prosecutor tried to explain to the jury, there's no way he could have gotten on that plane without people recognizing him. They would have had the fact that he was unremarkable means he wasn't injured, but it wasn't enough to convince a jury.
So that was really what hung people up, was that piece of it.
When we talked to the jury afterwards, and we didn't do it, the prosecutor did. And let it be known that there was a district attorney by the name of Kyle Reeves who prosecuted all three of the trials, and he took the trial. He was the only member of the Brooklyn District Attorney's Office that felt that this was a winnable case. And he advocated for Ashley, and he wanted to put this landlord, this arson for profit, greedy landlord in jail for this terrible, terrible act. So, you know, if Kyle Reeves is out there listening one day, he was waving that flag by himself, and he knew it was winnable. Unfortunately, we did lose the acquittal, the trial, and ultimately the acquittal, but he never gave up. And that's how I feel too. We got to give it the best shot we can and not just give up. We put everything we could into it to try and get this conviction. And this time, unfortunately, we came up a little short.
You know, I've been talking a lot recently on some other cases that are happening around the country dealing with circumstantial cases and the courage that it takes a prosecutor to take a circumstantial case to trial. And I'm with you. I salute that prosecutor. It's the right thing to do. It needs to be vetted. The thing that I think is so amazing, Tom, is that sometimes people think this is just a show up from 9 to 5, do your job and go home, but you never forget these families. Talk a little bit about Ashley's mom and this family and your relationship there.
Yeah, sure. I didn't get to know Ashley's mom at that time. The family liaison was Carolyn Sims, who was Sharon, the mom, her sister. And Sharon Sims was so distraught, obviously, about losing her daughter that she was not, she was too fragile to go through this process, quite frankly, and go through the liaisoning with the detectives and the prosecutors as the case went on. Now, remember, this case, the investigation was from New York to Miami to New Jersey to the Dominican Republic multiple times over a 7-month period. Right. So it was taxing on the family. So not only do they lose their child, but they have a drawn out, frustrating investigation because they know who did it. Right. And so now you're sitting there going, why aren't the police making an arrest? And so we liaisoned and communicated with the family through Carolyn to keep her apprised of the progress. And so we could convince her that everything was being done for her niece, Sharon's daughter. And why that's important, I think is pretty obvious. They need to know that their child there, if you're a victim and you survive, that everything's being done for you. And that if you're a survivor of a homicide victim, they need to understand that everything is being done that is possibly being done. And to not do that, you're re-victimizing them again, quite frankly. I mean, that's the only way I can put it. So I liaised on and became very close to Carolyn during that time. The only times I ever got to spend any time with her mother was one time during an update and then at any of the court proceedings. So, and again, not spending a lot of time. And I got really, really close with Carolyn. And I'm going to tell you something that's really fascinating to me. Do you know who took the phone calls every holiday, Christmas, and periodically? I did, from Carolyn. She reached out to us and never forgot us. It's not us not forgetting them. They never forgot us, and she made efforts. And up until the day I retired, we had always taken phone calls and exchanged phone calls. After I retired and I moved out of state, so we became estranged in some way. And then on, of all places, on LinkedIn, I get a LinkedIn message from Sharon Sims, and she said, "Is this Tom Joyce, the former commander of the lieutenant of the Cold Case Squad in the 79th Precinct?" And I was like, "Yes, ma'am." This through correspondence. Yes, ma'am. And then we agreed to talk, and she called me one day or she gave me her phone number and I called her. I was sitting in an airport getting ready to travel and for business, and just had the nicest chat with her and just reconnected and kind of listened to her journey of recovery. And she's writing a book. She doesn't even know if it's going to be published, but I think it's cathartic for her to write it and just her experiences. And I knew in talking to Sharon and her outreach to me all these years later, 19 years later, that we did what we were supposed to do as police officers and detectives, because we made her feel, she knew that we cared for her daughter and that we did everything we could. And what I will tell you, and I'm sure your audience knows, cops love overtime. You know, we don't make a lot of money in police work. You're never going to be rich. And so when they're offering up overtime, you're going to take it. And I can tell you, we ran out. We went way over our limit on overtime, where they said no more overtime on this case. You're not getting it. Nobody ever went home. Nobody ever went home on this case until Antonio was arrested, whether they were getting paid or not. And I know that. And to this day, I still talk to the detectives and the sergeants who worked on this case. Every single day I talk to them either through a text message or some level of communication, because they're the type of people that I would want to be associated with, because they were dedicated to the community. And they were just people who would run through walls for you any day, anytime, anywhere, with no questions asked. So
you and I have had this discussion in the past, and it's one of the painful parts of working in this profession, is that sometimes the bad guys win, but we have this faith that in the end things will be righted out, and there will be accountability in all things. Tommy, I want you to know how much you mean to me, and to hear this story reminds me of talking to some of your friends this morning. I put on I don't even know if you can see it. I'll pull this up. I threw on Chris's the shirt Chris gave me from Brooklyn Homicide in respect for you and your team and every police officer out there that's working for people who do not have a voice in these cases. It is rewarding to know that the family, through civil action, was able to get some accountability for this, but in the end, sometimes the bad guys win, and it doesn't stop you from doing your job. And I'm just so honored to be your friend and to take time with you today. And if you had a chance to talk to Ashley one more time, what would be the advice you'd give her, who would now be a 33, 34-year-old mom of her own? And we'll end with that.
Well, I would have hoped she would have been getting close to retiring from her WNBA career by now. And I think the advice that, I give my own children and I would give her is just go out of your way for people. And that's why we're a family of service. Knowing what I know now and, not allowing my son, because he's an adult and, you know, he can certainly do whatever he wants, but at least getting my blessing to become a police officer, and especially in these times, and my other son serving in the military, I think it's a great honor to serve. So even if you don't serve, and you're just, your mainstream employments or whatever, just live a life of helping people out, and it's, and I know you're familiar with it. We refer to ourselves, the military, as sheepdogs. Sometimes you're a sheepdog. Just one time, one day in your life, we chose to be sheepdogs for our careers and our life, that we chose that as for our life. But some people are capable of being a sheepdog, and they may never have to use it, or they use it that one time. And I would just say to any kid growing up is just, take care of people. When somebody needs your help, be there, do it, and give it the best you can.
Thanks, Tommy Joyce. There is something to be said for those who stand for the downtrodden, and you have done that for your career. I can't wait till COVID is clear and we meet each other again on the road, and I want you to know again how much I respect you and appreciate our friendship and the mentorship you've given me over the years. It's an absolute honor to be able to spend time with you, and I hope you'll come back.
I will. Unfortunately, we have a lot of cases that fit into your genre here, Mike, and all the feelings that you've passed on to me is they come right back to you. I feel the same exact way. So you and I are part of the Mutual Admiration Society together, because you're doing this on that side of the mic because you have the experience and you know what questions to ask and how to dig into these details of these investigations. So thank you for all you've done too, and spreading this word means a lot to me, because the communities really need to know that we're absolutely on their side, despite what some people might tell you. It's not true. It's simply not true. We're out there, and while everyone's running away from the firefight and the guns and the fire and the blaze, we're all running towards it. And there's men and women out there that are dedicated, and they want to serve you. And thanks for sharing, making sure that message keeps being told.
Well, thank you. Folks, Lieutenant Tommy Joyce, retired New York City Police Department. From all of us here at Profiling Evil Podcast, thank you so much. Check us out online at profilingevil.com. And again, share the message with your friends. And next time you see a cop out walking a street, just say to them thanks or give them a smile and a wave. It will mean the world to them. So until we get together next time, thanks again and have a great day. Thanks for listening to the Profiling Evil Podcast. If you enjoyed the show, don't forget to rate us and review us wherever you get your podcasts. And please, don't forget to go to our YouTube channel where you can watch some of the hundreds of videos we've created. Now, if you're looking for a great crime story, check out my new book, Deceived, an investigative memoir of the Zion Society cult. You can find it at profilingevil.com. While you're there, you can also sign up for our elite newsletter, The Bolo. I'm Mike King, and thanks for listening. Hey folks, it's Mike from Profiling Evil. I've been studying criminal behavior for more than 40 years, and one of my favorite research tools is TruthFinder. It's online, and you're not going to believe the information stored there. So if you want to know more about that new neighbor, your babysitter, or your online date, give TruthFinder a try. I'm including a special link below with special discount pricing, but you got to click the link and enter EVIL10 at checkout. Now, we're an affiliate, which means we get a small commission, but you can cancel at any time.